Okay, this is tape two. Tape two, side one. Could you describe how, if any, the atmosphere at Peenemunde changed as the war did start after 39?
Of course, the work schedule was very much intensified. No?
Mm-hmm. Well, after the A3, and you said you never had a real successful flight with the A3.
No.
What was next? The A5 came
the
next.
The A5, yeah.
Yeah.
Which was a small-scale A4.
Uh-huh.
And that's the A5.
And it was meant as a test of the A4 principles.
A test carrier, yeah, what you like to call it.
Now, the A3 was already designed and you were testing it, but the A5 was still undergoing design when you came to Peenemunde.
Yeah, it was started after the A3 firing.
After the A3 firing. So what role did you have in the A5?
Well, my activity changed somewhat because we needed measuring Geräte, gadgets, to fly with the rocket. And so I shifted gradually away from the test stand measurements into the missile measurements.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, we need a recording of the behavior of the control system. And since we didn't have a telemetering system yet, we developed a oscillograph which flew with a rocket in a very heavy case, and we could recover it, the case after the rocket landed in water. It was one of the reasons to fire from Greifswalder Oie.
Mm-hmm.
See that the rocket came down and dived into water rather than on solid ground.
So you
and
had
here you see how it came down, yeah, on the parachute.
This is photograph or picture number 6 of the A5 rocket with a parachute.
Actually two, yeah.
Oh, I see, two parachutes.
That's the so-called brake.
Mm-hmm.
Brake parachute to reduce the speed of the rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And after the speed was reduced to a certain extent, then the carrying parachute came out.
If you deployed the big parachute first, it would have created such
a crack.
It would have ripped.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this was in 1938 that you had these parachute retrievals.
Yeah, we started in 1938.
So parachute retrievals of small rockets and that sort of thing, of the A5, were common techniques for you at that time.
No.
They were not common.
We developed the parachutes ourselves.
You developed the parachutes yourselves for the A5.
Right. In connection with companies which were manufacturing parachutes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this combination of a brake parachute and the load parachute was ours. And
okay. Certainly, the conditions under which it was needed were unique to re-entering rocket.
Yeah, and then the whole ejecting mechanism. And
mm-hmm. That's the ejection mechanism for the parachute itself.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say in your comments for my own research that it was this design for the A5 that was intended to be used for the Reagan or Tona to eject it, not for the A4?
Now, maybe I misread your text.
That's okay.
I got the impression that you said the whole A4 was lowered on a parachute. It never was done.
That was never done.
No.
Yeah.
Not like this. Yeah.
So the early A4 tests were the rockets were never retrieved.
No.
Okay. And so the Reagan or Tona, if it were to be ejected by parachute as was planned, the system that it was developed from was the A5 system.
That's essentially, yeah. I don't know whether it was exactly the same type of parachute, maybe a bigger one or different one.
I know that they were discussing, as we'll talk about in a minute, a parachute that would start out partially deployed and then later fully deployed.
Now,
it had restraining ropes of different length and that sort of thing.
I couldn't remember that. But
that was something that was being designed for the Reagan-Urtona, not for the A-5.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But the final version of this Loach parachute was not a solid hull, but the parachute consists of bands.
Mm-hmm.
See, so you had the possibility that the air between the bands could escape, yeah?
Yeah.
To reduce the shock of putting the load on this parachute.
I see. I understand. That makes sense. Was this a successful design for the A-5?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
You retrieved... How many flights of A-5s were you involved in, or did they...
I tried to reestablish that. It's the hardest thing in the world.
Is it dozens? Many dozens?
I would say the best I could make out was that we about had 25 firings. But we used some of them for several flights. You see, we recovered them from the water and refitted them and fired them again.
Oh, that's really... So there was very little damage to them.
Yeah.
They were reusable. The first, these were the first reusable rockets, not the space shuttle.
Could say, yeah.
What did you learn from the A-5 that was important for building the A-4?
Yeah, essentially, you see, the A-5 was essentially designed for testing and developing the control system.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was entirely different control system in the A-5 in comparison to A-3.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started the development of two... Radio links? Yeah.
Okay.
One link was for cutting off the propulsion from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was for tracking the missile by means of a radio link.
Was that a Doppler?
Yeah, that was this Doppler system.
Doppler system, okay.
And it's also known as the Wohlmann system. Wohlmann was a professor from Dresden who...
What was his name?
Wohlmann.
V?
W-O-L-M-A-N.
Okay. You also had another term for the parachute. What was the name of the large parachute?
The Bender. Bender parachute. Or load. Do you mean load?
Load. L-O-A-D?
This is a brake.
Oh, brake and load. Okay.
And load, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Was the control system then that was designed and tested on the A-5, the control system that eventually was used on the A-4?
No.
No. So you found it wasn't successful?
It was successful, but it didn't suffice for the specifications of the A-4.
Mm-hmm. By the time you were working with the A-5, did the prospect of using rockets for ordnance, for military... missions become more immediate?
Sure, it was the beginning of the war.
So we're talking 40, 41 now?
No, it was still 39.
That was still 39, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Were you involved in plans to begin designing and building the A-4?
Well, as far as instrumentation is concerned. Yeah.
And how were your feelings now that you knew you were designing what was going to be an operational system?
Well, no, there was not much choice. It was war.
Oh, not a question of choice. No. But were you? See, I'm going back to some of the comments that we'll be talking about from David Irving and mm-hmm. Byershin's comments and others, where they said that scientists became reluctant to work for the war effort in Germany. And I'm wondering, I'd like to know, you wanted to talk about that period. Is this an appropriate place to start talking about that? Whether
eventually,
those were true?
Yeah.
True.
Now, well, of course, if you step into a war voluntarily or not voluntarily, I mean, you are more or less obliged to cooperate. I don't know that there would be any difference in any country in such a situation. It's
You wanted to talk about those pages in my article that they go from about, in the rough draft, pages 16 through pages 18, through 19, I think it was, where I do talk about one of those problems. We may be jumping ahead because I want to talk more about how you came to be assigned to work with the Reaganer group. What should we talk about first? Should we talk about how you came to that?
Doesn't matter. Now, see, the Reaganer work more or less fell into my field, which is onboard measuring systems.
That's very important. Okay. So it was your experience. But who made the decision that you would work on the Reaganer materials? Did you ask for it? Did you learn about it?
I didn't even know that there was already contact with Reaganer. And I think it was essentially Werner von Braun himself who assigned me to that.
Could you expand on Werner von Braun's interests in these measurements, the relative roles of the military need to gain data on the high atmosphere for ballistics and frictional heating and things like that, as opposed to the scientific, purely scientific interests?
Well, I think the scientific interest was number one. And doing it under aspects of military use of what was more or less an excuse. See, you had to justify that you did such things which were not of immediate military use. And so you find an excuse that you say, well, of course, we don't know anything about the atmosphere. We have to fly through somehow. We have to get the knowledge.
Did you prefer working on that sort of thing than on direct military ordnance?
Of course.
Were there people who were not asked by von Braun to work on the Reaganer problems or on other associated scientific problems who wanted to? Your knowledge, your own colleagues?
No, you see, we were so short in manpower.
Yeah. But still,
that particularly in my field, the measuring field, there was no overlapping with other assignments of other people. Yeah.
But
you see, measuring specialists are always a rarity.
Well,
you don't find them on the street, yeah.
If you were a rare commodity, how could von Braun afford to assign you then to a scientific mission and not an ordnance mission?
Well, he was blamed by Dornberger not on this particular thing, but on other issues, that his interests were too broad for wartime situation. Yeah.
Von Braun's were. Did Dornberger criticize him for this?
Yeah.
Did Dornberger know what von Braun was doing when he assigned you? In other words, did it draw criticism from Dornberger?
No, it didn't. As I said, how the contact with Reaganer took place, I just can't remember.
Stuhlinger recalls that it was part of a large wisdom day that he called.
Oh, yeah, sure. But Reaganer was not even involved in the wisdom day.
I see. So you don't know how Reaganer actually did get in contact with von Braun?
No, I couldn't tell.
Or vice versa. The question I also wanted to ask was, were you aware of any other scientific groups associated with Peenemünde as Reaganer's Friedrichshafen group was, that were doing scientific experiments, scientific research that was literally sold to the military in the same way as being of value to the military, but also having pure scientific interests? Were there any other identifiable teams?
No, at the universities. For instance, one typical thing was we were not sure what the jet exhaust, these hot gases, would do to our radio communications. whether there would be such an attenuation that we wouldn't get anything through. Mm-hmm. And all the ages-old problem, what is the effect of charging the rocket fuselage when an exhaust is burning. Mm-hmm. And so we had a contract with the Technical University of Darmstadt. And they had to investigate the charge effects on the hull of the rocket. Now, and that was, I should say, merely scientific problem. We had even a theoretical physicist working on this problem. There was a professor of physics, theoretical physics, Wessel.
W-E-S-S-E-L?
Yeah. I think he later on was a professor in Heidelberg after the war, as far as I can remember. And he was drafted by the Air Force as an officer, yeah, and he was most unhappy, of course, and somehow it could be arranged that he came to the Heeres, the army installation in Peenemünde, and he got assignment to my group, and he worked on this electrical charge problem in the rocket from the theoretical side.
But that was clearly an applied problem. You were taking physics and applying it to this specific problem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's different than Regener, who was certainly gathering information on the temperature, the pressure, the composition, the wind velocity.
Still it was an academic problem.
Okay. An academic problem supported in to better understand how missiles behave.
Right.
But also in
particular with this radio communications, how the rocket exhaust would influence the communication links.
Mm-hmm. Do you know of any other examples like this where academic scientists were brought in to perform theoretical calculations?
For instance, about the frequency stabilities of quartz oscillators. Mm-hmm. That was a problem which, to my knowledge, never has been solved.
Was Regener's experimentation, though, and projects, more blatantly scientific and less obviously applied than most of the other academic contracts that were brought in?
Well, I should say the general atmosphere was the same. Yeah? Mm-hmm. You see, we needed certain information about the environment for the flight of a rocket. Mm-hmm. And we found out that the basic knowledge was missing. So we had to initiate certain areas of basic research just for the understanding of what's going on.
Do you remember when you first met Regener and when your role in the project was defined?
Right.
When was that?
I couldn't tell exactly the date. I think it was in 42. Let's see here. This one.
What is the document you have there? It looks like a...
That's older stuff. That's about measurements on the A3.
Uh-huh.
Atmospheric measurements on the A3.
Development of a
barotermograph.
Barotermograph.
Measuring the atmospheric pressure and the temperature.
Uh-huh. Could I see these?
Sure.
Okay. These are... was this at Kohlensdorf? Berlin. 1936.
Yeah.
Were you involved that early?
No, but I took it over, yeah.
I see. I see.
What did I do to this? I hear that.
They used a bimetallic strip.
Yeah.
this is signed, I really can't tell who, these are all codes for the people who signed them down here, who were developing
that, these. That is Brown, Manfred Brown, that's Stonberger. And I don't know who that is.
Okay. And so they were interested in equipping the A3 as early as 1936 with with barographs, thermobarographs. But these were the standard kinds of instruments that were sent up on balloons for height measurement.
I shouldn't say standard, because it was a special development.
Oh, yeah. But the same measurements were made from balloon sondes to determine their altitude and stuff like that. Okay.
And the man who...
Can I see this? This is...
I think you know that one.
Oh, yes. This is the
meeting. I just wanted to look at the date.
Good. Yeah, that was July...
July 42. July it may have been in May 42 that I went with von Braun and Steinhoff and Zanzen, I think, to Friedrichshafen to meet Regner.
Ah, before this.
Yeah.
This meeting, which has been described in Clay in various other books as the beginning of the Regner program.
No, we paid him a visit before that.
I see. And what's your recollection of that visit?
Well, it was more or less getting acquainted with the work of Regner and his ideas and the possibility of applying his methods to rocket flight.
Uh-huh.
It's something preliminary. You see the first contact.
Sure. And that was with Steinhoff?
I think Steinhoff was there, but Braun, of course. And I think Zanzen was there.
That sounds familiar. T-S?
No, C-A-N-S-S-E-N.
Oh, no, that is not. S-S-E-N. Now, that's quite a long trip down to Friedrichshafen.
We flew down.
You flew.
See, we had our own bomber.
Oh, I see. Well, that's
Steinhoff. Steinhoff was an expert pilot.
Of course, yes.
Do you know the story? He was holding distance record in a glider plane. Hmm. He flew from the Wasserkuppe nach to Brünn in Czechoslovakia.
No, I didn't know that.
Before the war.
Wow.
And then he was so well known for his flying capability that at the Olympiad in Berlin in 1936, there was a big demonstration of Zeppelins. We still had a couple of them. We were directed to make propaganda flights on top of the Olympic Stadium. And Steinhoff made a loop around one of the Zeppelins with an glider plane. It's typical for him.
He was a real daredevil.
A crazy guy.
Oh, my gosh, that's neat. So let's go back to this May of 46 meeting. Okay, you were on the bomber, so clearly the flight wasn't very long. It was just a few hours, is that right?
Yeah,
Was that the first time, one of the first times you were in an airplane, actually? Or you
oh, no.
By then
no.
you'd been in
no.
airplanes. Okay. Can you recall what the flavor was like upon meeting Regner and how Regner and von Braun got along? Had they met before, obviously? Did they know each other?
I couldn't tell for sure.
What was your impression of Regner? What kind of a person was he?
Oh, he was a very pleasant person. I hoped he would be my doctor father, but do you know what a doctor father is? It's
thesis advisor, PhD, thesis advisor?
I call it Dr. Faber.
Okay.
But he died just at that very moment.
That was in 55?
Yeah.
1955 approximately, or in the early 50s. Mm. I see.
I personally had a very pleasant relation with him. Mm-hmm.
How did his staff treat him? Was his word absolute law? Did he
everybody? I mean, Regner wasn't that kind of a person. I mean, they were colleagues of him, yeah, and they were very outstanding ones.
Emmert,
I could say I was a friend of Emmert. Yeah. We liked each other very much. Emmert and Schopper and Petzold. And
Petzold came a little later. He really wasn't in this meeting, and he was hired, or he was brought in a little later. He was younger. But
Wait a minute. I think he was a student of Regner.
I think so.
He got his doctorate with him, I think.
Okay, I better check that. He didn't mention that himself when I wrote
it. As far as I can recall.
We're thinking of Pätzold. The others were, but I'm not sure about Pätzold. Okay. Now, Regener, of course, had his own troubles in 1938 as well. His wife and his son had to leave. Did you tell me that his wife was Jewish?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. And they had to leave primarily for that reason, or included
I suppose. I think Regener was requested to see if he was a professor at the university, and they had to abide to these racial requirements.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, but you could ask Victoria, if I'm not mistaken, he was required by the party to divorce his wife if he wanted to stay as a professor.
I see. And he didn't divorce his wife. No.
Regener or not.
No. Okay. I want to gain a sense of him as a human being, as a personality, and you're helping me tremendously here. It's very, very
useful. No, he was an extremely pleasant pleasant person.
You'd rate him as fair, as concerned with bringing up his colleagues and letting
absolutely,
them work on their own projects.
Absolutely, yeah.
You don't recall the meeting then in May well enough to say what Regener's own interests were in doing all of this. Did he have to be convinced? Was he very conservative, or was he really anxious?
I remember that we talked quite a lot about balloons. You see, he had a high reputation about reaching extreme altitudes with his balloons. Mm-hmm. And I remember very well the location. You know, that was the summer resort of this father of Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker.
Down in Friedrichshafen?
Yeah.
And it
was quite a modernistic house.
It was very pleasant.
Oh,
how much time did you spend down there? Was it several days?
Maybe a couple of days or so.
A couple of days. Mm. And what was your sense of the result of the meeting when you left? Was he going to participate?
Oh, sure. I mean, he was very eager. This was a unique opportunity for him to reach real high altitudes.
Do you know if he continued balloon ascents during
this
time?
I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. He did some ballooning.
Well, do you know that he went to extremely heights and to extreme depth?
Yes, yes. I know he went down to the bottom of Lake Constance and other places. And he went into mines as well. Mm-hmm. He took his counters all over the place. Schulinger recalls that Regener did not fly any cosmic ray equipment, but yet von Braun, in his deposition, in his interrogation with Fritz Zwicky, says that ion counters were sent up in as part of the Regener Tona. No ion counters, though, were identified here or in the documents.
Not at this stage.
No.
As long as I was involved, we didn't talk about cosmic ray measurements.
Why was that? Because was that too much pure? There was no applied.
Well, you had to have a starting point. You had to first fly the more or less conventional things, and then go to the sophisticated things. I mean, nobody knew real well how the ton would behave.
But the ion, the cosmic ray counters were far less sophisticated than the ultraviolet spectrograph he designed for it.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
No. Of course, that was always a problem with our measurements, at least the external measurements, how the measurements were influenced by the, what should I call the flat atmosphere? Yeah? You see, it's a certain kind of a flow around such a body at these high velocities. Yeah? And we were always a little bit shaky about behavior of measurements in this flat atmosphere. Yeah? Even conventional instruments like a pitot rod or a pitot tube or a static tube or even Samadhana. And we had to gain some experience with that.
Yeah. It is curious because cosmic ray counters were the first thing flown by American people, and they were very, very simple. Just mm-hmm. the very simple Geiger tubes. And I'm just wondering whether the military justification was more difficult for a Geiger tube than it was for a UV spectrograph.
As far as I can recall, of course, Regener had his own interests. And as I can recall, what he was at that time mainly interested was this ultraviolet barrier.
Yes, that's certainly true.
And he, I have another impression at that time was he was more interested in the ultraviolet research than in the cosmic rays research in a rocket.
Okay. I know that ozone research had gone way back in his work, but he also did a lot of cosmic ray work. That's why he was in the bottoms of the ocean. That sort of thing. He was doing both. Okay. Certainly his work with his son in 1934 through 36, developing an ultraviolet spectrograph for balloons was one of his big projects. Yeah. And that was really quite something. I assume he talked about that. Did you see some of his balloon songs when you were there? So there's. So he saved some, maybe. I'd love to get my hands on one. Yes. Did you meet Fatzer at this time?
No, I couldn't recall it that time.
Okay.
I met Fatzer later on in in Lindau, where Emot had very close connections with Emot.
I know that Fatzer is no longer alive.
No, he died after.
I'm not sure about Emot.
Oh, he died before Fatzer.
He did. Oh, okay.
So. It was a very sad moment.
It was unexpected?
Yeah, well, he suffered from angina pectoris and
angina, heart disease.
And well, someday he didn't make it anymore.
Okay, let me go up to the point where Regener and what were your responsibilities then? You remained in Peenemünde.
Yeah.
Regener was working in Friedrichshafen.
Right.
Friedrichshafen. What kind of contact? Did you fly back and forth? And were you a liaison, a technical liaison?
I was maybe the best characterization of technical liaison. I was quite familiar with the electrical and electronics arrangements in the A4 rocket. And this system had to fit in there. But at that time, we were already under such time pressure that I couldn't afford too many trips anymore just to go to Friedrichshafen and talk problems. And I remember, I think I mentioned it to you in one of my letters, that this Dr. Rau came to Peenemünde more frequently.
Dr. Rau, R-A-U, yes.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that, but I've not been able to track down anything more about him.
Petzold might know.
Petzold. Okay, I can write him.
And I'm surprised that Schopper didn't respond.
Schopper did not respond, no. And he's at CERN now, isn't he?
No, that's the other Schopper.
Oops, I sent it to the wrong Schopper.
Didn't I give you the address?
Let's. I'll put this on hold.
I think he had to stop the teacher, things like that. He was very poor shape a few years ago.
I heard that he was in poor health, but he sent me some very, very good, very helpful comments. I'm going to definitely check on that. Okay. And the tape recording record will help me remember that I should get in contact with the correct Schopper. Yeah. Okay. Good.
What year are we talking about now?
42, 43.
You mentioned once before that somewhere along the way here,
I want to get you up to June of 43. You said around the spring of 43 you joined General Dornberger's staff. Let us get up to that point. We've identified what your involvement was. You mentioned Dr. Rau. You mentioned in your letters to me that at the point where you left the Regener project and you had no choice, you were detailed. Things were obviously getting tighter. Schedules were getting tighter. The Wasserfall
started to be hectic.
Very hectic. The Wasserfall project was coming up, as were others, a typhoon, things like that. And you said that they were still doing general design analysis, that trying to get the configuration of the Tona straightened out at this time. This sounds right to you?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's wonderful. Because I have some documents from Dr. Patesold that, if I can retrieve quickly, there they are, will show you, just because it happens, he sent me two records of meetings, three records of meetings, actually, that took place in May and June of 1943. Mm-hmm. This is already when you left, because Weiss, Dr. Krauss...
Yeah, see, Dr. Weiss took over from me.
Exactly, exactly. Here are these documents, enclosure 2 and 3, from Dr. Patesold. And one is May 4th, 43. The other one is June 3rd and June 4th of 43. Both of these meetings were in Friedrichshafen.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little more about Dr. Weiss, Dr. Krauss, if you knew him, and Engineer Helsen? If you know Engineer Helsen's initials, what his first name was, that would be... that just says DI. That's his engineer. Here are the documents. And I'll put this on hold for a minute and give you a chance to read these. But you just said that you were not aware that Helsen was involved.
Do you know this one?
Yes. This is the...
Frank Winter brought it back, I guess.
That's right. In fact, Dr. Patesold sent me... that's the same one. This is a review of schedule, the itinerary for the testing, final integration of the Tona, starting in October of 44, ending in January of 45. It starts on page 2, curiously enough. All of these start on page 2.
That probably was a cover letter.
Yeah. There is, in fact, I think you have more in here than I've seen these. That's right. Yeah, these are bits and pieces of the pictures of the spectrograph.
Now, the original pictures aren't mentioned,
I wrote to Rathchen about these pictures and sent him Xeroxes. I've got a few of them. But this one, the most important.
Yeah, right, to these.
Deutsches Museum to Heinrich. No, I've not written to Heinrich or Romalo, only to Walter Rathchen.
He's remote from that. He's not in the...
Okay, because the one critical picture he couldn't find, he could find the others.
Yeah.
But the one...
He has to go to Heinrich anyway.
You see this picture of the spectrograph opened?
Yeah.
That's the
one
he couldn't get. And that's the one I wanted more than anything, so we could see the components. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, we should get that record of the person we should write to. Well, look, we should also simply, we could write to Otto Meyer, who is...
He's very busy.
I know. Well, we have somebody working here who knows
him
very well.
I missed to meet with him. We were supposed to have a conference on computerizing their documentation, and
that'd be good.
It just fizzled in.
That's too bad. What do you think of these two documents?
Let's see.
Yeah, it's very long, but it describes all the very broad technical problems, such as the design of the Tona, some wind tunnel tests of models of the Tona. The problem of the parachute is throughout this whole thing described. And when it gets down to the scientific apparatus, such as the ultraviolet spectrograph, it's only in the most general outline that these things are discussed. Now, what I'd like to get from you, if possible, is that you've already left the project. What? Oh, no, I can hear myself. It wouldn't happen otherwise. You'd already left the project, but not too long before this. And, of course, when these were written and when these meetings took place, was just about the time when, it was just about D-Day, in fact, June of 43. And it was also just about the time when the V-2 went awry that landed in Sweden.
Just about.
And this went a month or a few weeks. I'd love to get some sort of a background feeling of how the atmosphere changed at Peenemunde during this time, because of course the story is, it seems to be developing that it became more and more difficult at Peenemunde to do any projects that were not absolutely directly related to producing as many V2s and making them work as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things were happening, and this was the state of the project at this time. It wasn't very far along. What are your feelings about this in terms of the reason for the long period of development? Could you give me a sense of it? I know you went to Wasserfall. Could you tell me what happened to others in the project, with the Reginer project at least? Do you know when others had to leave?
You mean other personnel of Peenemünde?
Yeah, had to leave for more direct involvement in development.
There were two things which were actually the disadvantage of the V2 development. One thing was the militarization. At that time, it was already decided to motorize the whole deployment of the V2 in the field.
Yeah.
And that was a tremendous undertaking. And the industry was not prepared at all to assume such a assignment. So our people had to be sent to the industry firms and whatnot to just get it going.
This is the development of the Meilerwagen and things like
such
that.
Things, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was a tremendous project. And
these were afterthoughts, actually, in the project?
What do you mean by afterthoughts?
They weren't initially designed into the project. They were big parts of the project that were developed later on.
Yeah. You see, I remember very well when von Braun told me that, as it became acute that the poor V2 should be deployed in the front, that von Braun asked Dornberger, now say, we are not military people, somebody should tell us how that should be done. We don't know how to deploy in such a technical vehicle, such a flying vehicle or what, in the front situation and how military workings should be. And Dornberger said, oh, don't you worry, there will be 6 general staff officers coming from Berlin and they will solve your problem. He never came.
They never showed up.
And so our people had to apply their own imagination how you could do that. And that how the motorized version of the deployment came about.
Mm-hmm.
And we had another genius, one of the old rocketeers, who actually designed the whole thing. This was tremendous what he put together without any military help.
What I'm looking for is the fact that is new projects that, like Wasserfall and others, that would have taken more people off the Reginer project. I know that Peitzold had to leave from time to time to work on the Wasserfall. Do you know of any other?
Peitzold?
Yes. I may have it wrong, but someone else in the group did leave and work on Wasserfall every so often. You don't have that recollection. Do you know of any of the other Reginer team people, either in Peenemunde or Friedrichshafen, who were taken off the project to work on war-related things? No, you don't.
I don't remember anything.
Okay, fine.
But see, and this motorization was not the only thing.
Yeah.
Then it was decided that the V2 should go into production.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this very difficult transition period that the development device should be converted into an industrial device, so to speak, one you can manufacture in large quantities.
Right.
And there was nobody available for real doing that than the development people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was one of the great shortcomings of Peenemünde that we had to employ our own high-qualified development people with these industrial aspects of the whole thing.
Let me turn the table over.